This week's show is sponsored by Audible, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want with Audible.
It's time for Making Sense with Steve Laser.
Y'all ready for this?
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Making Sense with Steve Laser and the Rude Pundit, the show that breaks down the top issues in the last week in politics, strips out all the nonsense, and provides you the best analysis in political media. No Rude Pundit this week, but I've got a lot to talk with you about, including more positive news regarding the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, along with a new term that I'd like us all to start using for a dishonest tactic that Republicans use. Then we'll have an analysis of the failure of supply-side economics in Kansas. And then if I have time, I'll talk with you all about the Ebola crisis in Africa. And at the end, we'll have our trademark weekly Hall of Shame. You won't want to miss that. If you want to write to me and give me your feedback about anything we talked about on the show, write to makingsenseletters@yahoo.com, and I may read your email on the air next week. Again, that's makingsenseletters@yahoo.com. Our top story on good news for Obamacare and a discussion of GOP spin begins now. Ladies and gentlemen, before I get into the specifics of the good news regarding Obamacare, I think it makes sense to talk about a couple of things and work up to what's going on with the Affordable Care Act. You see, at some point in the future, historians will look back at the presidency of Barack Obama, and I think they're going to find it one of the most interesting presidencies to analyze for a couple of reasons. Now, at the top of that list of reasons is going to be the ways in which the Republicans concocted their opposition to him. Now, in articles, I've said from pretty early on in Obama's presidency, from articles that I wrote in spring and summer 2009, that Republicans had two ways to go, and their choice, you know, as evidenced by the way they were behaving, was pretty clear. They were faced with this guy, President Obama, who had tremendous popularity when elected, a mandate for change, the first black president, all of that. And they could either try to ride the wave and work with him, and in so doing, try to get as many of their ideas, Republican ideas, incorporated into what was to come as possible, as many as they could. Or they could oppose him 100% and try to tear him down, and in doing so, pretty much take themselves down with him as well, and potentially take down the country. Right? Because that's how bad things were with the economy. We were losing 800,000 jobs a month. Things were bad. And we could tell in March of 2009, with the beginnings of the modern Tea Party nonsense, that Republicans had chosen the second option. That's clear by now, right? They chose scorched earth, oppose him at any cost, whatever. Now, I say that this option is going to take them down as well because it radicalized the Republican Party. There are pretty much no moderate elected Republicans left. The only appeal that Republicans have to moderate Americans is that after Obama's policies have been demonized as much as they have been, Republicans' appeal is that they aren't Obama and oppose his policies. That's the only appeal that Republicans have right now. If they score victories in election 2014, that and low turnout by Democrats will be the only reasons why. Moderate Americans are not in favor of any part of the current Republican agenda, not the economic, not the social, and not the foreign policy agenda of Republicans. Now, that's part of the damage that Republicans have done to themselves and their brand these last 6 years, and it will make winning the 2016 presidential elections virtually impossible for the Republican, whoever the nominee is, virtually impossible. Now, one of the ways Republicans opposed the president was to make dire and, in some cases, pretty wild predictions about his policies. Predictions that his policies would fail and cause various catastrophes, you name it. Killing grandma, death panels. Now, the addition of the Tea Party movement that began in February of March of 2009 was started to oppose the president's stimulus bill that he put forth to stop the economic collapse that was occurring at that time. Again, as I mentioned, the country was losing 800,000 jobs a month when the president was inaugurated. That's the economy that he was handed by outgoing President Bush. It's hard to imagine now, right? But the Tea Party and the Republican Party that embraced it said that the stimulus and the rest of President Obama's policies would not help the economy, in fact, would make it worse. Now, looking back now, that seems completely wrong and preposterous, right? The president's policies have completely turned the economy around. I mentioned last week on the show how one of Forbes' authors rated President Obama, the magazine Forbes, rated President Obama's economic turnaround the best and highest job creating since the Second World War. Better than Clinton, better than Reagan, number one. President Obama's economic turnaround. But Republicans said it would fail and it would make the economy worse. That's what they said in 2009. And actually well into 2010 and 2011, still criticizing his economic policies. And look how well they have turned out. Not only have record numbers of jobs been created, there have been increases in manufacturing, the real estate market has recovered, businesses are doing extremely well, and the equity markets are doing very well. It's fair to say that the president's economic policies have brought about both a deep and broad-based economic recovery. And Republicans have not suffered any consequences at all for that incorrect prediction on the most basic thing that matters to all Americans. As the saying goes, it's the economy, stupid. One would think that the American people would no longer trust Republicans on the economy or anything else after being so badly wrong about whether President Obama's economic policies would work, and that the American people would throw Republicans out of office in large numbers as a result. But that isn't happening. Why? Well, as they have with all of their wildly wrong predictions, Republicans are banking on enough time passing between their incorrect predictions and the actual results. So the American people forget what the Republicans said. Now, I apologize for this lengthy preamble, but I think it will become meaningful in a moment as we get to Obamacare. There were so many crazy predictions by Republicans about Obamacare that I can't get to them all in this piece. But I want to focus on two or three that were in the news recently. Okay, and this is even beyond the killing grandma, the death panels, and all that other crazy stuff for which they won awards for Lie of the Year by various fact-checking organizations. This is beyond that, okay? I'm not even counting that at this point. Of course, they did say those things, but let's not even count those. I want to focus on fairly recent statements that they made, recent as in the last year or two. One of them that you saw a lot about just 6 to 10 months ago was that not enough young people were going to sign up, and this would cause premiums to double or triple in 2015, and thus Obamacare would fail because everyone would then pull out. There were a lot of segments done on conservative media where they tried to tell young people that Obamacare was terrible, don't sign up. They brought young people on to various conservative TV and radio outlets where they were saying that they weren't going to sign up, that it was, you know, a terrible thing. I was involved in several debates about whether young people should sign up. First of all, we learned early on in 2014 that over 25% of eligible folks under 30 had signed up for Obamacare, and that exceeded what was necessary for the plan to be viable. But it's one thing to say that, and it's another to see what happens to the premiums the next year as a result. Well, the stats have begun to come out about what premiums will be in 2015. Now remember, Republicans predicted disaster. Double digit or more, double or triple, the rates would increase, premiums would be unaffordable, people would abandon Obamacare wholesale. But the stats have begun to come out, as I said. The Kaiser family did a study and found out that not only will premiums not go up at all in the Obamacare policies and exchanges in 2015, that they will decrease slightly. So Republicans were very wrong about that. Are they going to receive any punishment from the voters from throwing ridiculous predictions out there about Obamacare premiums? Well, it doesn't seem so at this point, does it? This week, there were two important news stories out about Obamacare. One was that new insurance companies are flocking to the exchanges to offer policies in the 2015 version of the exchanges. Health and Human Services Secretary Sylvia Burwell announced during a speech this past Tuesday at the Brookings Institution that the number of companies offering plans on the Obamacare Affordable Care Act's health exchange marketplace for 2015 will jump to 248, a 25% increase over 2014 in the 44 states where the numbers are available. So consumers will have additional choices when they choose their policies this year. That's an interesting situation, considering that in various ways Republicans have been claiming that the economics of Obamacare don't add up. Well, the free market has spoken, and private insurance companies want to offer their services on the exchange. Apparently the economics do add up, don't they? Additionally, stats have shown that for every new insurance option added on a state's exchange, consumers see a 4% reduction in premium prices. So these additional insurance options will put further downward pressure on premium prices. Now, the other piece of news that came out this week was very important. Because, you see, Republicans have been claiming that Obamacare will not reduce medical costs. They won't reduce health care costs. That's what Republicans have been saying for years about the Affordable Care Act. And as recently as this year, they say it has been a failure at reducing costs. Even some moderates and some Democrats have been saying that they were disappointed at the lack of cost-cutting measures in Obamacare. The president has been saying to everyone, wait and see, you'll see. There are a number of things in Obamacare that are going to put downward pressure, not just on premium prices that I talked about, folks, but on prices of procedures and what it costs to go to the doctor, hospitals, etc. But Republicans, from the very beginning, it's going to drive up prices. Well, you can probably tell what's coming now, right, folks? Once again, at the Tuesday meeting at the Brookings Institute, Secretary Burwell announced that expanded health coverage under the Affordable Care Act will save U.S. hospitals $5.7 billion this year on the cost of caring for uninsured Americans. Diving into the report shows that nearly three-quarters of the savings, $4.2 billion, will occur in states that have opted to expand the Medicaid, healthcare program for the poor as part of Obamacare. So those hospitals in red states with the Republican governors who refuse to expand their Medicaid can thank those governors for the losses that they incurred treating uninsured patients. But more to the point, Obamacare is creating massive amounts of savings. Just in this regard, hospitals treating uninsured patients, $5.7 billion. And this savings will again be passed on to consumers in the form of lower premiums. We probably won't start seeing that savings until 2016, but it will be there. Of course, I expect hospitals and insurance companies will take some of that in profit, but a fair amount will be passed on to policyholders as well, all across the health spectrum, not just people who have Obamacare policies. Health insurance, employer health insurance plans will see decreases in premium prices as a result, everyone. Again, will Republicans be penalized by the voters for being so wrong? Somehow I doubt it. I think we've got to coin a new phrase for this strategy by Republicans. They're clearly doing it deliberately. We see it over and over again. They're doing it on purpose. I'm certain of it. Now, when I thought of this strategy, this idea of throwing these lies against policies and things like that well in advance, and then being nowhere to be found when it turns out that they're wrong. When I thought of this strategy in my mind, I called it the preemptive Orwellian doublespeak. But I've actually thought of a better term for it. I'm calling it the liperbole, the Republican liperbole. They used the liperbole against the stimulus. They used it against Obamacare. Even the so-called scandals, Fast and Furious, IRS, and Benghazi, were, I think, examples of the Republican use of liperbole. None of those scandals panned out. None of them. Not Benghazi, not Fast and Furious, not IRS. No wrongdoing found regarding the Obama administration. Again, the dynamics of the Republican liperbole are that you attack the administration's policies or initiatives or handling of an issue and claim that all of these bad things were done or will happen with the goal of driving down the administration's approval level and creating dissatisfaction with the policy. By the time the truth comes out, many months or years later, the truth no longer matters. The public continues to feel negatively about the administration's policy or handling of the event, no matter what evidence comes out later or how successful the policy turns out to be. And you can see how successful this liperbole strategy is by the Republicans. I talked last week about how successful the administration has been with the economy. Talked about it some more today. President Obama's approval level should be in the 60 to 70% range for that reason alone. But Republicans talked for years about how his policies weren't working. It turns out he did a better and faster job getting out of the recession than Reagan did in the 80s. Does he get credit for it? No, because of Republican liperboles. We will continue to see evidence of Republican liperboles on healthcare reform as we get closer to 2015. Obamacare has been successful, and evidence of that is only going to increase. But the public still has a negative opinion on Obamacare. Why? Why at this point do they have a negative opinion of Obamacare when it is so clear that the policy is succeeded? Why do people have a negative opinion of it? Why do people have a negative opinion on President Obama's handling of the economy? No one has been as successful on the economy, particularly turning around a deep recession or depression in modern times. Nobody has been this successful. Why do people have a negative opinion of his handling of the economy? Folks, the cynical tactic by the Republicans works. That's the simple fact. It works. It has worked. And it will continue to work until we all call it out and force them to stop using it by making sure it no longer works and it hurts them. We'll be right back. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want with Audible. Listeners of Making Sense with Steve Laser can get a free audiobook and 30-day trial membership if they sign up at www.audibletrial.com/lasersense. If you want to listen to it, Audible has it. With over 150,000 titles in virtually every genre, you'll find what you're looking for. For instance, Inferno, the latest novel by Dan Brown, is available, as is The Cuckoo's Calling by Robert Galbraith. Sign up now at www.audibletrial.com/lasersense. Welcome back to Making Sense with Steve Laser. Well, folks, I had a chance a few months back to sit down and talk with Art Laffer in the green room at Fox News. If you don't recall who Art Laffer is, Laffer was a member of Ronald Reagan's economic team and is considered one of the fathers of supply-side economics. He's said to have illustrated the concept to Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and others in 1974 by drawing a curve on a napkin and talking about how, in his opinion, well, not in his opinion, tax revenues would be zero if taxes were either 0% or 100%. So the maximum revenue point is somewhere in between. That's very basic, right? That's straightforward. But Laffer made the argument that the maximum revenue point is much lower. It's a much lower tax percentage than previously thought. Hence, he argued that current American tax rates are higher than that number and should be cut. And that's where the Republican belief comes from, that lowering the tax rates create more tax revenue. Now, this was popularized as the Laffer curve, even though Laffer himself doesn't claim to have invented the concept and says he learned it from folks like John Maynard Keynes. But ever since, Republicans have been of the belief that lower taxes always mean more revenues. Now, most Republicans don't understand exactly what the Laffer curve means. Even Laffer himself would say that if you go too low, that was going to create less tax revenue. Now, I disagree with Art Laffer, and I told him that in person. By the way, he's a very nice guy, very gracious, if anybody gets the chance to talk with him, I encourage you to do so. He's a very nice guy. I don't think the point of maximum revenue is lower than was thought. And every piece of evidence seems to agree with me. I hope you're all with me on this. And if not, don't worry. The wonkiness is not going to continue for very long. It's going to get very practical very quickly. But every piece of evidence seems to agree with me. Moreover, there is no evidence to suggest that supply-side economics produces a better economy than does traditional demand-side economics. Now, I've talked about this before on the show, but the recovery that happened under Reagan was due to the fact that the price of oil and gas went down by almost half during Reagan's first 2 to 3 years in office. The oil embargoes of the 1970s, as a result of the 1973 war between Israel and the Arab countries, that, you know, where the U.S. supported Israel, and also the U.S. problems were Iran, with Iran, you know, those two incidents caused various Arab countries to supply us with, and much of the rest of the world, with less oil. But that was over with, and the supply of oil began to go up in the very beginning of Reagan's administration. So the price of oil and gas fell, and by a lot. Now, what we didn't know then, but definitely understand now, is how powerful the effect of lowering oil and gas prices is on the economy. Now, we knew already by the time of Reagan how much an increase in the gas prices can have an effect on the economy. We saw that during the 70s with stagflation and all those problems during the latter part of the Nixon administration and the Ford administration and, of course, the Carter administration. But what we now know is you could have had monkeys running the economy in the Reagan administration, and the economy would still have taken off like a rocket ship. That's what happens when you cut the price of oil and gas almost in half. The economy takes off like a rocket ship. If the price of oil or gas goes up or down by a lot, it's really hard to do anything to stop its effects on the economy in either direction. Now, since Reagan, Republican presidents George Herbert Walker Bush and George W. Bush, as well as a number of Republican governors, have attempted to replicate Reagan's success by lowering taxes. And you know what? They have never been able to reproduce it. It doesn't work. It's like the scientists who claimed they had achieved cold fusion a number of years back. It seemed to work once. We don't know why it worked that time, but it has never been reproducible. Now, we know why Reagan's experiment with supply-side economics worked, and it has nothing to do with him or his economic policies. Now, the latest attempt to explore the limits of the dynamics of the theory of supply-side economics has come in the state of Kansas. Kansas's Governor Sam Brownback came to office in 2011 and decided to implement a 25% tax cut on the highest state income tax bracket in his state and eliminated a tax on small business income. Brownback reasoned that supply-side theory showed that the state would actually take in more taxes by lowering the tax rates, and more businesses would want to move to Kansas. And if supply-side theory worked, he would have been right. That's exactly what would have happened. But what actually happened is that Kansas's tax collections are down $685 million for the year. And as the June article about it in the Wall Street Journal by Mark Peters and Damian Paletta pointed out, this comes at a time when virtually all other states in the country are showing revenue growth. It's gotten so bad in Kansas that they're desperately going after those who aren't paying taxes and selling every little thing that they own, individuals and businesses, including, as it turns out, their sex toys. That's how desperate Kansas is. The Huffington Post's Samantha Lackman noted that Kansas is auctioning off furry handcuffs and vibrators seized by their revenue department. That's how bad it is. Lackman quotes State Senate Democratic Minority Leader Anthony Hensley, who noted that, quote, Brownback is so desperate to fill the massive hole in the state budget caused by his reckless income tax cuts that the state of Kansas is now in the porn business. This is the same governor whose supporters spent this past week attacking his opponent for a strip club incident. Now, Kansas is expected to face a $238 million budget shortfall by the summer of 2016, and the state brought in $282 million less in personal income taxes than it expected in fiscal 2014. Now, of course, this issue with Brownback's failure in Kansas is particularly important to the people of Kansas, but his failure, along with the failures of Presidents George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush to replicate Reagan's success with supply-side economics, is more than enough evidence for all of us to conclude that Laffer was not right. Those who promote supply-side economics are not right. The point of maximum tax revenue, the percentage, is not lower than was previously thought. And it is not as Laffer suggested to various leading Republicans since 1974. Now, we have all the evidence, folks. Two Republican administrations, we have Brownback's experience in Kansas, there are plenty other Republican governors who have also failed. And, their economies of their state have done much worse than other states after they have cut taxes. We're starting to see that now with New Jersey. New Jersey is starting to have tax revenue issues, problems balancing the budget. So you know what I say, folks? It's more than time for Republicans to own up to the fact that they are championing a failed theory. America will be much better off if Republicans return to the economic policies of Nixon and Eisenhower, two presidents who presided over balanced budgets and responsible tax and spending policies. I had Susan Eisenhower on the show right around a year ago. Maybe it's time to replay her segment. I might replay it in the coming weeks. Her grandfather, Dwight David Eisenhower, balanced the budget, was a very responsible president economically, and it's unfortunate that for some reason Reagan is the model that all Republicans point to. He's their hero, their economic hero and whatever else, when Eisenhower is the one who had a balanced budget. And Reagan is the president who started the modern practice of massive deficit spending. That's not the guy to emulate. But the point here is that supply-side economics don't work, and it's time for Republicans to own up with it. Note, no supply-side president has come close to balancing the budget. Just think about that. Reagan didn't balance the budget. George Herbert Walker Bush didn't balance the budget. George W. Bush didn't balance the budget. They didn't come close. Republicans are still touting this theory as this fantastic new way of running the economy, but it's never come close to producing a balanced budget. So I think it's time to throw supply-side economics into the dustbin of history, where it belongs. We'll be right back. We don't get fooled again.
It's the most powerful as well, and it triggers memories and emotions, and is the most compelling aspect to make you feel wonderful. At scentaprises.com, that's scenterprises.com, we take you on a fragrance journey to learn about the magic and mystery of scent to create your very own custom perfume. We have an exquisite range of perfume blends which spans the entire fragrance palette, from sparkling citrus notes to light, fresh, and clean herbals and marine notes, florals that everyone will love, such as fresh, gentle, sexy, and heady florientals. And if you prefer sophisticated fragrances, our blends of spicy, amber, woodsy, musky, mossy, and luscious gourmand vanilla notes are warm, sensual, and combine beautifully with all the blends. So why wear what everyone else wears when you can create your very own custom perfume? Be different. Contact Sue at scentaprises.com. Scentaprises, our business makes you sensational.
There's bad news and good news in the fight against Ebola this week. First, the bad news. There were more attacks on medical aid workers and journalists this week by local citizens that are scared and believing either crazy religious or political conspiracy theories. AP reported that a Red Cross team was attacked while collecting bodies believed to be infected with Ebola in southeastern Guinea. One Red Cross worker is recovering after being wounded in the neck in Tuesday's attack in Forakaria, according to Benoit Carpentier, a spokesman for the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. Family members of the dead initially set upon the six volunteers and vandalized their cars, said Miriam Berry, a resident. Now, eventually a crowd went to the regional health office, where they threw rocks at the building. Now, the attack is the most recent in a series that have plagued teams working to bury bodies safely and also provide information about Ebola and disinfect public places. The most shocking was the abduction and killing last week in Guinea of eight people, including healthcare workers educating people about Ebola and the journalists accompanying them. So a lot of fear and anger associated with this outbreak, as you know, you might expect. Also on the not-so-good front news front, well, I guess depending upon how you look at it, it could be good or bad, but the government of Sierra Leone has ordered a quarantine that affects nearly 2 million people. The government specified various districts to be quarantined as a result of the potential spread of the Ebola virus infections, and this affects, get this, one-third of Sierra Leone's 6 million people. Now, so far, in parts of Sierra Leone and neighboring Liberia, where these quarantines have been in effect, food prices have soared, some markets have closed, and the delivery of goods have slowed. Now, this is just another way the negative effects of an outbreak like this manifests itself. It's not just the disease, folks. It's how the entire infrastructure of an area can break down when you have a health crisis like this. It's a lot of ways that this is really scary, and things like this could get scary. It's what I think about every once in a while about influenza. If we had a major pandemic of influenza, it could get like this. The government of Sierra Leone put out a release saying, there is a desperate need to step up our response to this dreaded disease. The prognosis is that without additional interventions or changes in community behavior, the numbers will increase exponentially and the situation will rapidly deteriorate. Now, I checked out the numbers, folks. As of now, 3,000 people are known to have died from the outbreak since it began, and the numbers seem to be accelerating. At least 600 of the 3,000 who have died just since the beginning of September. I'll give you some more numbers a little bit later. But what I want to talk about now is that there is some good news to report as well. CNN and other news agencies are reporting that a limited test has gone well and may provide relief and a cure for those infected with the virus. A man by the name of Dr. Gobi Logan is a doctor in rural Liberia whose practice has been inundated with Ebola patients. And out of desperation, and perhaps some intuition, he tried a drug that is used to treat HIV. The drug is called lamivudine. Now, just to give you an idea of how virulent Ebola is and how much promise this drug seems to have, across West Africa, around 70% of the folks who were infected by the virus have died. Now, Dr. Logan has given the drug, lamivudine, to 15 Ebola patients, and all but two survived. That's a 7% mortality rate versus the 70% rate for folks who have not been treated. Now, CNN visited Dr. Logan's clinic, and they talk about in articles how survivors are walking around Logan's Ebola Center in Tubanverg, there are four of his recovering patients walking around. They're staying inside a fence. They're still quarantined off from the rest of the population, but CNN visited them and went to talk to them. And they talked to 23-year-old Elizabeth Kundu, who said that her stomach was hurting, she was feeling weak, she was vomiting. She talks about how bad it got with the virus. Then they gave her the medicine, and she said she's feeling fine. She said, we take it, and we can eat. We're feeling fine in our bodies. Now, the 13 patients who survived all started treatment within the first 5 days of becoming infected with Ebola. The two who died started treatment after that date. So, again, if it's not some sort of statistic anomaly, it means that if you start treatment with lamivudine early enough, you have a strong chance of surviving. And, of course, a lot more testing needs to be done. Infectious disease doctors in the U.S. say the idea that lamivudine might work against Ebola makes sense, and that there are enough similarities in the structure of the Ebola and HIV viruses that suggest the drug could be effective against both. Now, lamivudine is also apparently effective against a number of other viruses, including hepatitis B. So this is great news for the people of the region and promises to offer hope that this horrible Ebola outbreak can be brought under control. And something like this is desperately needed. As I said earlier, according to the World Health Organization, over 3,000 have already died from the outbreak of Ebola, and the latest figures indicate that more than 6,500 people are believed to have been infected. The World Health Organization says the numbers of infected could rise to more than 20,000 by early November, and that would produce 14,000 deaths if 70% died. So that shows you how desperately the hope offered by lamivudine is needed. We'll be right back with our Hall of Shame after this.
Hey now, you're an all-star. Get your game on, go play. Hey now, you're a rock star. Get the show on, get paid. All that glitters is gold.
What's the biggest fallacy about diamonds? More facets are better and will create more fire. Doesn't that make sense? Nothing could be farther from the truth. In fact, larger facets create more fire. The new Blaze Cut is a unique square diamond with a fabulous display of colors never before seen emanating from a diamond. In fact, the Blaze Diamond has 9 times the fire of any other round diamond of the same size. It took a genius to invent the Blaze Diamond, and an amazing artist to highlight the beauty in fine jewelry. View Blaze Diamond Jewelry by Bez Ambar on Badler.com, BADLER.com, or search Blaze Diamond on YouTube to see remarkable videos. Experience this new innovation by coming to Maurice Badler Fine Jewelry in New York City, 485 Park Avenue between 58th and 59th Streets. Visit Badler.com for more information or call 800-M-BADLER. That's 800-M-B-A-D-L-E-R.
Zero Zeliot uploaded.
Welcome back. And now it's time for our trademark weekly Hall of Shame, the part of the show where we highlight politicians and other prominent individuals who have engaged in the worst and most shameful nonsense of the week. In third place in our Hall of Shame, we have Sarah Palin, the Republican 2008 vice presidential nominee. Now, I think it's really important to get simple and basic facts right in speeches if you are the current vice president or president or a past presidential or vice presidential nominee. Now, I realize there are very few folks who fall into one of those categories, but Sarah Palin is one of those people. Now, sure, we all make mistakes sometimes. President Obama makes mistakes. Vice President Biden makes mistakes. And frankly, when I make fun of silly things that right-wingers have said, I usually get thrown back at me that President Obama, when he was the Democratic nominee in the run-up to the 2008 elections, mentioned in a tired moment that he had visited, quote, 57 states during the campaign. Now, if you investigate what happened then, and Snopes has a really good article on this, the problem with that criticism is that it was at the end of a very long campaign day. And what President Obama meant to say is that up until that time, he had visited 47 of the 48 continental states, but he slipped up and said 57 instead of 47. So it's really not that big of a deal, and it wasn't like he didn't know the answer, right? So under those conditions, it's understandable. These days, very few of Sarah Palin's days are long. She gives a few speeches a week, and that might be overstating it a bit. She gets paid a lot of money for them, and outside of that, really isn't doing too much outside of participating in the occasional brawl at a neighbor's house. But getting back to the importance of getting basic facts straight. If you're going to attack someone, it's really important to get the facts right. Because if you mess up facts when you're attacking someone, it really makes you look stupid. Let's listen to a part of Sarah Palin's speech from the Values Voters Summit in Washington, D.C. this past Friday afternoon.
They scream racism, are we just to end debate? Well, don't retreat. You reload with truth, which I know is an endangered species at 1400 Pennsylvania Avenue anyway, truth.
1400 Pennsylvania Avenue, eh, Sarah? Well, as most of you know, that's not the right address. If you were to try to go to 1400 Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C., you would find yourself at the Willard Intercontinental Hotel. I wonder if Sarah was making a comment on the guests or management of the hotel. Who knows with her? No, of course not. We know that she wasn't. She was trying to talk about the White House, and she didn't get the address right. Then Palin made an interesting statement. If you've seen the movie Game Change, that was a really eye-opening movie for me, by the way. But if you saw the movie, you learned a lot of things about Sarah Palin and what it was like to try to prepare her, not even so much for the job of vice president, but of trying to make this person appear as if they have a snowball's chance of doing a good job at vice president. And if, God forbid necessary, I don't even like to think about this, as president, they had to do so many things to give the illusion that she was somewhere in the ballpark, and it still didn't work. But if you saw the movie, you know that for the vice presidential debate, Palin didn't come close to knowing enough about the facts to where her handlers thought that she had a chance of making a good showing against Joe Biden. So what her handlers did was they gave her instructions where if she didn't know the answer, she would pivot or change the subject to something not too far away from what they were discussing, but then again, she wouldn't be answering the questions either. So she would pivot, give one of a number of canned responses to these different topics, and therefore not appear like she didn't know the answer. So I found it interesting during her speech when she said this.
The lies that you tell about us, well, you can't defeat our arguments, so all you can do is change the subject.
I think hypocrisy has actually become a virtue for conservatives and Republicans. I think they admire that in their candidates at this point. I mean, Her biggest moment in politics was the vice presidential debate. And in that debate, she did exactly what she complains about her critics allegedly doing. And by the way, they're not. So for not knowing the address of the White House, and then accusing Democrats of what, in fact, she does and had to do to appear within light years of being competent as a potential vice presidential nominee, Sarah Palin is third this week in our Hall of Shame for Worst Nonsense of the Week. In second place in our Hall of Shame, we have Sean Grubert, now former South Carolina state trooper. I think it says a lot that during a time when there has been a lot of focus on issues of the police's use of force as a result of a number of incidents, this incident stands out even when compared with Ferguson. Ferguson, of course, had the biggest backlash in terms of the community, but this incident involving former trooper Grubert is really the most egregious. And I think it's because of the video that in no uncertain terms makes it clear what happened. Former Officer Grubert is seen in that video pulling over LeVar Jones on September 4th, and the incident begins with Jones getting out of his vehicle at a gas station in Columbia, South Carolina. Now, to this point, Mr. Jones has no idea that a policeman is interested in him. And when he gets out, former Officer Grubert asks Jones to produce his driver's license. As Jones reaches into his car to get it, Grubert becomes agitated and shouts, quote, "Get out of the car!" And when Mr. Jones starts to do exactly that, to exit his body out of the car, Grubert opens fire, firing three shots, at least one of which hits Jones in the hip. You can just hear Jones on the video sometime after that saying, I was just getting my license. And he says, "Sir, why was I shot? All I did was reach for my license. I'm coming home from work." In effect, what happened here is former Trooper Grubert shot this guy for obeying his commands exactly and quickly. He did exactly what the officer said to do and was shot. The good news is the right thing was eventually done here by South Carolina, the state, and the folks who run the state trooper folks over there. And Mr. Grubert was fired, and he was arrested this past Wednesday and charged with assault and battery of a high and aggravated nature, a felony which in South Carolina carries a potential sentence of up to 20 years in prison. Now, I think that would be a fair sentence for someone who had the public trust and violated it by shooting someone who was doing nothing but obeying their commands. Sean Grubert is runner-up in our Hall of Shame this week for infamous nonsense. But the winner of our Hall of Shame this week really could probably win the award for the whole year. And guess what? He is a Republican nominee for Congress who is probably going to win. He is Wisconsin State Senator Glenn Grothman, who was running for Congress to represent Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District. This guy, folks, he just epitomizes what a winner of my Hall of Shame looks like and sounds like. This guy is so outlandish, I almost can just play audio of him and call it a night on the show. Here are some clips of him as played on The Ed Show on MSNBC. And everyone, you know, I want you to really pay attention, because while it's outlandish that he says these things, it really is. The things that he says and stands for are really terrible. But you know what? I think that if 95% of Republican politicians talked without a filter and said what they really believed, that this is what it would sound like. Let's listen.
"I know a lot of gals who are having kids out of wedlock.
I was the author of the 24-hour waiting period for abortions.
You talk to an average girl, average gal.
The vast majority of women who are having children, they are not accidents. I think people are trained to say that this is a surprise to me because there's still enough of a stigma that they're supposed to say this.
The man who led the repeal of the Equal Pay Act could argue that money is more important for men.
A lot of women like to stay at home and have their husbands be the primary breadwinner.
But the leadership class in this country had sent a clear message to all these nice, cute, middle-class girls."
Now, that was just some of his anti-women greatest hits. Yeah, you heard all of that right, including the part where he says money is more important to men. As noted in a Mother Jones article by Andy Krall, that snippet comes out of an interview he gave in 2011 where he said, quote, Take a hypothetical husband and wife who are both lawyers, but the husband is working 50 or 60 hours a week, going all out, making 200 grand a year. The woman takes time off, raises kids, is not go, go, go. Now they're 50 years old, the husband is making 200 grand a year, the woman is making 40 grand a year. It wasn't discrimination. There was a different sense of urgency in each person. You could argue that money is more important for men. I think a guy in their first job, maybe because they expect to be a breadwinner someday, may be a little more money conscious. And that's what he said. And at a 2010 Tea Party rally, Grothman said, in the long run, a lot of women like to stay at home and have their husbands be the primary breadwinner. Now, I'm going to go into some more of his shameful statements. But you might be asking why I'm talking about this guy now, since a lot of these statements are weeks or even years old. Well, first of all, Mr. Grothman still believes these things, and he is not ashamed to tell anyone. Second, Grothman, who up until now was just a state senator for Wisconsin, a few weeks ago won the Republican primary to try to represent Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District in the U.S. House of Representatives. And guess what? He is expected to beat his Democratic opponent. So this guy, in just a few months, could be voting to decide social policy and all other policies for all of us. Here are some of his other beliefs. He thinks that we should end the weekend. Yes, you heard that right. Wisconsin state law says that each worker has to be given at least a day off each week. He thinks people don't use their downtime efficiently, so we should end the requirements for employers to give people at least one day off a week. Make folks work 7 days a week, according to him. This guy might be deciding policy for all of us. In a 2004 op-ed calling for new restrictions on the federal food stamps program, Grothman outlined the extensive research that informed his position. He said, quote, I've interviewed over a dozen people who check out people who pay with food stamps, and all felt people on food stamps ate better or at least more costly than they did. Observations of people who work in food stores indicate that many people who use food stamps do not act as if they are genuinely poor. You can just feel the empathy pouring out of this guy. And his evidence is 12 people say. I mean, that's only marginally better than I read it on the internet, so it must be true. Now, rounding out some of his more ridiculous opinions is that he says that sex education can make kids gay and that Planned Parenthood is racist. And as I said earlier, he's not shy about these opinions. If you interview him, he will tell you this is what he believes. And again, this guy is leading in his race against his Democratic opponent. This guy is probably going to be in Congress. Angels and ministers of grace defend us. Wisconsin State Senator Glenn Grothman, the Republican nominee for Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District, wins the award for worst and most shameful nonsense of the week. That's all we have for today's show. Thank you for listening. The next episode of Making Sense with Steve Laser will air live at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio next Sunday, October 5th, and Monday, October 6th at 2 p.m. Pacific Time on KCAA Radio, 1050 a.m. in Inland Empire, California. Be sure to follow The Rude Pundit at rudepundit.blogspot.com and follow me and the show on Twitter at Stephen Laser, on Facebook at Making Sense with Steve Laser, and on my blog at stevelaser.blogspot.com. Until next time, have a great rest of your day and a great week.